Accession number 8984, roll number 5.
Commander Dreyer, Reel 5. Now, we said earlier that your estimate at the beginning of the war was that the German Navy might be inefficient in deploying their forces in the course of combat. Were there any specific examples which actually occurred within your own personal experience?
Well, yes, in a way. Taking the German E-boats, for example, these were marvellous boats. They were rather bigger than our small boats, 108 feet long, and they had the superb advantage of the Mercedes-Benz diesel, the lightweight diesel engine. They were very fast. They, for such big boats, they could do comfortable 40 knots, and they could, like our early part of the war boats, they could cruise at sort of 35 knots indefinitely. And they were very good, very efficient boats. But when one thinks of our East Coast and remembers that 3 nights a week there was a convoy going down the East Coast, and 3 nights a week there was a convoy going up the East Coast, and those convoys for much of the war were probably 50 ships, and because of the sandbanks they could be only 2 ships in a column, only 2 columns wide, so that the convoy was probably the best part of 8 or 9 miles long. For much of the middle part of the war, a 50-ship East Coast convoy had probably at the outside 10 escorts. It would have had 2 or perhaps 3 destroyer escorts, which would be probably old V's and W's with converted to anti-aircraft purposes, or Hunt class, or of course my old Ludlow, the American one. They would have had some MLs which had a 3-pounder single shot gun, like a saluting gun, and I think a twin Oerlikon, but it may have been 2 single Oerlikons. You know, a fairly limited armament. When one compares that to what we had to attack going through Dover, for example, or what the East Coast convoy, the East Coast MTB flotillas had operating down the Dutch coast, I mean, they had better convoys than we to attack, with 4 or 5 ships perhaps in a convoy and only 10 or a dozen escorts. But when one compares what we had to attack and our success with it with what the Germans had to attack down the East Coast and their success with that, the result is deplorable. They ought to have slaughtered the East Coast, and they didn't achieve doing it.
Did you realise that at the time?
Yes, I think we were conscious that they ought to have been doing more. Of course, one of the things that did happen in the middle of the war is that quite a lot of the boats were withdrawn to the Baltic to take part in the Russian campaign. And obviously that depleted their numbers. But nevertheless, I think we were conscious that they didn't operate enough. and they didn't make use, as we would have done, we thought, of the opportunities that appeared to us to be available to them.
How would an MTB compare with an Ebert in actual combat?
In equipment, we had two sorts of MTB, the big ones and the little ones. And the big ones were roughly the same size as the German E-boats, or rather bigger, much slower, and rather more heavily armed with guns, but with the same number of torpedoes. The little ones, in which I served all my time, the 70-foot boats, we had two 21-inch torpedoes, and they had two 21-inch torpedoes in an E-boat, and we had a twin 0.5 machine gun, and they had one 40-millimeter gun and one twin 20-millimeter for much of the time. Later on, they got another 40-millimeter. So they would have been rather more heavily armed with guns than us. But, of course, we didn't do, or very seldom did, anti-boat patrols. The motor gunboats did that work. Our motor gunboats, which didn't have torpedo tubes, but had guns instead. And they were rather formidable for dealing with E-boats. The small motor gunboat had a two-pounder pom-pom forward and a twin Ehrlichan aft, and later on the two-pounder pom-pom became a six-pounder semi-automatic gun, which was really a quite tough anti-tank gun, and you didn't need many hits with that to sink an E-boat. You probably stopped it with one hit. So, does that answer your question to an extent?
Yes. So, if an MTB of your class found itself by accident in single combat, say, with an E-boat,
it would lose. At least it ought to lose. The twin 0.5 machine gun was a good gun for killing people, but it wasn't really a gun that you could sink boats with. If you were concentrated and were able to concentrate on hitting the engine room, you probably would perhaps be able to do a lot of damage in there and put it out of action. But you're not going to sink a boat with 0.5 machine guns.
Did you ever come at any stage in the war into contact with German naval captives, POWs?
Yes. Oh, yes. At the end of the war, during the invasion time, I helped interrogate two or three E-boat chaps who we captured at that time. And then just after the end of the invasion, in I suppose October of 1944, we sank a rather celebrated chap called Charlie Müller, who was sunk off the East Coast with his entire unit of three E-boats. Two of them were sunk because they ran into each other, but the other one was actually sunk by us. And Charlie was captured, and Peter Scott and I interrogated him for a long time. And it's rather a joke story, that, really, because after we'd finished with when we were talking to him, we were told by the Naval Intelligence Division in the Admiralty that we could say anything to Charlie because he was in prison for the rest of the war, and so it just didn't matter what we said. And we talked for 10 hours, utterly openly, comparing notes about operating and methods and systems and how we operated and how they operated, and criticising each other. And Charlie talked very good and fluent English, and I talk practically no German, and Peter talked some German, but we did it all in English. And we had the greatest fun and most entertaining, and he was a very charming and amusing character. But at the end of our interrogation, we said to the Naval Intelligence Division, we've finished with Charlie, we can't get any more of value from him. And we went our way. And a few days later, Charlie Müller was repatriated to Germany. And he was swapped for somebody who'd been captured out of one of the invested ports, Bordeaux or Brest or one of those ports on the west coast of France that was invested. And by some extraordinary misarrangement, Charlie was made available and was repatriated. And he went straight on the staff of the FDS, the Führer der Schnellbooten, in Emden, and proceeded to put all the good lessons we'd taught him to use against us. In point of fact, of course, the war was practically finished by then, and they didn't really matter all that much. But it was an ineptitude.
But the authorities presumably knew that you'd told him
absolutely, but the message hadn't got out to the level. They were literally, Charlie and the whole party were about to be shipped out to America, and somebody, while he was standing on the jetty, said, any volunteers for repatriation? And Charlie took two paces forward and was repatriated.
But you similarly learnt a lot from him, presumably.
Oh yes, but I don't know that we learnt an awful lot that we didn't already know, but we confirmed an awful lot. It was really more of interest, because by that stage of the war we were so much on top, and you know we had most effective radar, particularly from shore, but also not in our boats. We had very modest radar in our boats throughout the war, but in destroyers and frigates that controlled the boats, we had very effective radar, and they didn't have any radar at all, really. And they only had a thing called a search receiver, which picked up people's radar looking for them. But it made such a noise that for much of the time they switched it off. They were ill-equipped in their boats from that technical point of view, compared to us.
So Müller showed no disinclination to talk. He didn't.
Not at all. No. He said firmly, "The war is finished. The war is over. The only thing I won't do is give you any information that is liable to help you to kill my friends." And I don't think he did. I don't think we learnt anything enabled us to kill his friends any better out of chatting with him.
But of the other POWs whom you interrogated, did they stick to the usual name, rank and number
to
business?
A large extent, yes. Oh yes. Our interest at that stage, there were two or three E-boats sunk in the run-up period to the invasion. And really the major interest of the interrogators was to be sure whether they had any clue as to what was going on. And our interest in coastal forces really was just to establish what boats they had, what equipment they had, what they were doing, how they were operating. And the only chaps I remember talking to were the captain of one boat, who was a chief petty officer, and he was very uncooperative and really wouldn't say anything at all. And there was one midshipman who did talk fairly reasonably freely, but all one really got off him was the names of who was in command of which boat and where they were and that sort of thing. It was
rather more gossip than actual knowledge. But we kept a book in Portsmouth. Peter Scott was very keen on it, and I think it was a most valuable thing to try and assess and know about our enemy across the way. We were very conscious of who was there and how they operated and what their troops thought of them and that sort of thing.
So you got some impression of them as personalities?
Yes, just that, and how they might behave. And we did get from that midshipman, whose name was Simulkovsky, I remember, but we did get a certain amount of knowledge of who was there and what they were like.
Did German naval personnel, from your own personal experience, seem to be of the Nazi type or the professional naval type?
No, what? I don't. Well, the officers that I met then and subsequently, quite honestly, seemed exactly like us. The two or three that I got to know well after the war were perfectly charming chaps, couldn't have been nicer. They certainly didn't appear Nazi types in any degree.
Coming on to the British boats again, you talked a bit about the crews, but were the crews all regular sailors?
No. Nor the officers. I mean, for example, in the 24th flotilla, my last flotilla, I was the only RN officer in the whole outfit. Some of the coxswains were RN petty officers, but almost the whole of the crews were hostilities only sailors of different sorts. Most of the boats had a motor mechanic rather than an engine room artificer, which is the naval rank. A motor mechanic was a wartime hostilities only rank of petty officer or chief motor mechanic, of, you know, what it says, a skilled motorman from garages, engineering works, given naval training in operating boats. And the chiefs of practically all our boats by the middle of the war were motor mechanics. And not only our boats, of course, but in the base staff, practically the whole of the technical staff in the bases were Wrens. I mean, it was perfectly staggering by 1943 that one's engines, hull, guns, radio, radar, torpedoes were all looked after by Wrens, with a smattering of sailors together with them. Some of the chief petty officers in the base staff would be RN or motor mechanic hostilities only ratings, but the large majority of everything was maintained by Wrens. It was a staggering effort there.
What was their work like?
Superb. I mean, quite as good as sailors. They had the most wonderful effect when they came on board to do the maintenance on board. All sailors stopped swearing, too. It was very valuable.
Did you find that conscripts were as good as regulars or not?
In their specific field, yes. You see, for example, an RNVR wartime-only lieutenant, say, who was the captain of an MTB, would be certainly just as good as an RN officer as the captain of an MTB. But the difference being that whereas an RN officer could go off and become the turret officer of a 15-inch gun or the navigator of a destroyer or
any other job throughout all the different sizes of ships, the RNVR officers were trained for their specific one job only, and they joined coastal forces at the beginning of their training, and they mainly stayed with us throughout their time, and they were frightfully good at it. I think they were quite startlingly efficient and really good, and large numbers of them became amazingly expert in that field. Some of them had the capability to go on and command destroyers afterwards, and some did, but not very many. Because, of course, most of them who were with us were pretty young. I mean, again, my 24th flotilla, I was then 24 when I had that flotilla, 25 in the last part of it, and I suppose I was one of the oldest COs of the lot, and several of them were 20 or 21.
But what about the hostilities-only people amongst the crew?
Well, again, they were limited to their specific function. I mean, probably, again, I had in that flotilla, I had a leading telegraphist, Frank Langford, who was a wonderful character. And I should think all the other telegraphists were hostilities-only ones in all the other eight boats. My coxswain was a petty officer pensioner, but no other member of my own boat was RN. But, for example, the torpedoman was an I can remember him very vividly. He was a market gardener from near Guildford. But he was a highly capable torpedoman in an MTB. He couldn't have gone readily and been a useful member of the torpedo party in a cruiser, but he was highly capable of looking after the torpedoes and what little electrics we had in an MTB.
I think you were saying earlier about the operation of MTBs, about the discomforts as far as getting soaked was concerned.
Yes, it was. I mean, a little 70-foot boat operating in a force 4 blow, which was a force 4 wind, and the resulting sea was about the limit of what we could operate effectively in and fire the armament effectively in. You can stay at sea, and if you had to make a passage, you could do it in much worse weather, but you couldn't fight in much more than that. Going to sea in that weather, at an early stage, after you'd left harbour, green seas would start to arrive in the bridge, and you would be soaked, and although you had a towel around your neck and a thing called a goon suit, which was a sort of waterproof overall suit covering you, water seeped down, and at a fairly early stage you were sopping wet and sitting in a pool of water, and it did get awfully uncomfy, and you were jolly miserable at sea in rough weather. And likewise, of course, the telegraphist stuck in his little cabin down below, bouncing about down there. Many of them were seasick, and it was pretty miserable. The engine room crew, there was frequently an awful smell of mixed petrol and leaking exhaust and
fuel and hot pipes with oil dripping on them, and the smell from all that. There was usually a pretty filthy smell in the engine room, and a lot of them, you didn't get so much movement back there, but a lot of them did suffer from seasickness.
Did you find that your expectations about, your hopes about MTBs before you went into them were actually fulfilled?
Oh, I think so. I think they performed a most tremendous service through the war. For example, both in the Sicilian operation and in the invasion of Europe, they performed a most tremendous task of protecting the whole of, in the first place, of blocking the Straits of Messina, and in the second one of protecting the cross-channel convoy routes from all attack. I think they did do a terrific service. I haven't got the statistics in my head of what they achieved in the course of the war in terms of sinking things, but it was something fairly formidable.